back to France almost 24 hours later. The first leg of the trip involved a bus from Pitlochry to Edinburgh. I sat beside a pair of young women and a very fat baby girl who I'm guessing belonged to one of them. The two took turns holding her. I watched as the first put the child on her knee and pushed chocolate candies into her tiny mouth with her fingers. Then she handed her to her friend, who poured some Coca-Cola into a baby bottle and had the kid suck on it until she vomited. After that, she was handed back over for a candy refill. The baby wore several gold bracelets and rings, and I wondered how she'd ever get them off her ever-expanding wrists and fingers. October 4th, New York. This afternoon, David Rakoff and I went to see The River Wild. It was preceded by a very lengthy preview for the new Warren Beatty movie. The thing went on, and just as it ended, David turned to me, whispering, "I understand the remaining 7 seconds of this film are remarkable." Later at dinner, Paul D. tried to tell us that cows are nocturnal, but that farmers force them to stay awake during the day. That is so funny to me, the idea of keeping a cow awake. October 31st. As research for the new play, One Woman's Shoe, Amy and I went to the welfare office on 14th Street. We'd wondered what we might say if anyone asked why we were there and decided on, "They told us to come back on Monday." But nobody asked. I got the idea it's possible to spend all day in the welfare office without being asked any questions. After entering the ground floor waiting room, we joined a line that never moved. Out of 6 windows, only 2 were open, and the woman behind one of them was dressed for Halloween as a cat with ears and whiskers. There was some confusion as to what the line we were standing in was for. The woman ahead of us had no teeth and had brought a wooden crate she used as a chair. Sometime later, a Hispanic woman tried to sneak her friend into the line, and the toothless woman called for security. "I know who's in front of me, and I know who's behind me," she said, "and she went no way in front of me, or I would have seen her." Other people chimed in, but the Hispanic woman stood her ground, claiming that her friend needed to cut in line because she has asthma. "Oh, yeah? Well, my baby's got asthma, too," a black woman said. "Oh, really? Where's the baby?" The black woman pointed to her stomach. "In here." The Hispanic woman's friend was booted to the back of the line. Like a lot of other people, she was dressed in spandex pants. These she wore with a T-shirt that pictured a number of cartoon pigs fucking in various positions. Everyone in line seemed to have a story about a misplaced form, a missing check, a stolen wallet. Everyone complained about the staff. "They make it hard, hoping we'll just give up and go away. The bitches is acting like the money come out of their own pockets. Someone told me they're hiring at UPS, a woman said to one of the few men in the office. "I ain't working for them, because I'm a certified chef," the man said. People limped and had their arms in slings. One man walked like he was a marionette worked by a novice, his legs bent almost to a kneeling position. The office was filthy, and everyone ignored the no-smoking signs. There were crumbs and cigarette butts on the floor, the noise of fights and crying children. The seats were all occupied by exhausted-looking people, some sleeping, hardly any of them reading. "I've been here since 9 this morning." There were white people, black people, Puerto Ricans, Japanese, an Indian family. The mother talked like she was channeling a spirit while her daughter stared straight ahead. Loudspeakers would call out her name, but the person was hardly ever there. People seemed to know each other. They socialized, so much time spent waiting. There were signs everywhere. "Take the name of your caseworker. Remember to keep your appointments." The signs were all marked with graffiti. Men would approach waiting women, and the women would ignore them, sometimes surrendering their seats to get away. A woman with braids left the line every so often to spit in the trash can. A grown man suckled a pacifier and dribbled saliva all over his hands. He would lift his shirt, walk in a circle, then stare at the wall as if it were a mirror and laugh. It felt wrong to be there. Amy and I could leave any time we wanted to. The others either could or couldn't, depending on how you think about it. Which brings us back to the play. December 14th. I went to a deli on 2nd Avenue and 73rd Street for lunch and waited behind a 75-year-old woman with wild gray hair and sad, poorly fitting slacks. She ordered a bit of chicken salad, and when the clerk asked for her definition of a bit, the woman turned to me and rolled her eyes. "See, they don't know, 'cause they can't talk English. I want to make myself a sandwich at home. I got bread at home. But they don't understand." December 27th. Christmas afternoon, Dad pulled out his film projector and a half a dozen Super 8 movies from the late 60s and early 70s. I recall him standing in front of us with his camera back then, but like the photos he takes of us on the stairs every year, I never knew what became of them. Two friends of Lisa's had dropped by, and though nothing could be duller than watching someone else's home movies, none of us cared. The moment we saw Mom, we forgot about our guests. They mumbled something on their way out, "Merry Christmas," or maybe, "Your kitchen's on fire," whatever. I never knew my mother had been captured on film, moving. The first reel was from St. John in 1972, Mom, Dad, Aunt Joyce, and Uncle Dick. We see the island, boats, more island, more boats, and then there's Mom, who waves goodbye before ducking into a thatched hut. Then the camera is handed to someone else, and we see Dad pull her out. He is young and handsome. He is always handsome. When he points at the camera, Mom buries her head in his chest. Then he lifts her chin, and they kiss. Watching this, Dad stomped his foot on the floor, the way you might if you just missed the bus, and knew that another wasn't coming for a long while. He rewound the film and played it a second time, then a third. "Again," we called. "Play it again." To see them both on an island, so young and happy, I couldn't believe our luck to have this on film. ''95, January 9th, New York. I cleaned for Judith today. Her full-time housekeeper, Faith, showed up half an hour late, so I waited outside and was joined by Mary, the young woman who comes once a month to trim the cat's toenails. She used to work at an animal hospital and has, she said, a house full of critters. First, there's a ferret whose goal in life was to escape his cage and murder the guinea pigs, which he did. She loves birds, but only if they can fly freely through her apartment. She also loves cats, and found a way to make everyone happy by adopting a blind one. That way it can hear the birds, but not catch them. Mary told me it's illegal to have a monkey in New York City because they carry human diseases. That said, she's treated two of them. These were people who won the lottery, she said. They got the money, and the first thing they did was buy their son the two capuchins he wanted. The monkeys went from living in the son's room to living in the garage, and eventually they wound up in a shed far from the house. They were bloodthirsty, apparently, and before they were banished, the son was regularly treated for injuries. January 11th. I followed two men on the street. One was telling the other that he hates it when Danielle holds his hand. "'Cause there might be some other piece I want to talk to. You know what I'm saying?" January 24th. The review of One Woman Shoe came out in Newsday, and it's good. The guy said that after a while, he didn't know what the hell was going on, but didn't care he was laughing so hard. He said it was stronger and more satisfying than the woefully erratic Stitches, which is funny. Last year they wrote a love letter to it, and now it's erratic. The Times review comes out on Thursday. January 26th. We got a wonderful review in the Times. Rakoff called late last night to read it to me, and I thought he was kidding. It changes things, a review. First off, it kills the element of surprise and leaves the audience with a prove-it stance. It fucks with the cast as well. Everyone was off tonight. One moment bumped into another, and the show felt way too long. We were excited by the great review, but by the end of the night, we were depressed. July 7th. Someone stopped Mitch on the street last night and said, "I need another 75 cents so I can buy a cheeseburger. How about helping me?" Mitch said, "Get it without the cheese," and continued walking. September 18th. A woman phoned at 11 o'clock last night and asked if she could speak to Rich. I said there wasn't a Rich here. Okay, she said, is this the game we're going to play? Game? Listen, I said, Rich is having his roommate cover for him, is that it? There is no roommate. Listen, this is David Sedaris and Hugh Hamrick. Rich, is that you, you shithead? There is no Rich, I repeated. You have the wrong number. You think you can fuck with me, Rich? You have no idea who you're fucking with. That's just it, I said. I don't have any idea. None whatsoever. This is wasted on me. She hung up then, hard. January 1st, New York. Amy's New Year's resolution is to make more Asian friends. She hopes to find them at community meetings and small restaurants. I think that's great, to have a goal. Hugh's friend Sue, who's from Georgia, had a New Year's Day luncheon and served ham, collard greens, and black-eyed peas, traditional southern food meant to bring good luck and prosperity. She cooked the collards with a penny. I told Amy about it, and now we're trying to think of other recipes that call for change. January 24th. It really is torture to sit around the house and write all day. I'm thinking it might motivate me to finish the book faster, the thought that after it's finished I can return to house cleaning. Problem is that I haven't even started the book yet. Today I wrote a letter to Karen Dobergos, a girl I went to high school with. She sent me a Christmas card over a year ago, so I responded to it. Check. Then I read a 35-page story written by a guy in Colorado named Robert. He sent it to me weeks ago and called last night asking why he hadn't heard from me. His story was not easy to read. All the characters said things like, "What are you doing?" and "Nothing." Then I wrote two letters of recommendation. It doesn't sound like much in terms of progress, but I sat at my desk from noon until 6:30, practically. January 30th. Helen called me over to give me a chicken quiche, but really to complain about the excessive heat. The landlord suggests she keep her windows open, but she says that if she does, it'll let out all the air conditioning. It makes no sense to have that running in the winter, but she does, along with the heat and three fans. February 8th. In the paper, there's a story about a 55-year-old cancer patient who paid her 20-year-old neighbor to kill her. The kid went with strangulation, but she revived and then tracked him down, claiming that because she was still alive, he had to give her the money back. They argued, and he beat her to death with a power drill. February 12th. According to an article I read this morning, scouting was invented to rescue boys from the clutches of their mothers and schoolteachers. The fear was that they turn out gay or deviant, as they said back then. Parents were advised to be on the lookout for boys who willingly took baths and kept diaries. Guilty and guilty again. February 27th, Albany, New York. William Kennedy and his wife are a waiter's worst nightmare. At dinner last night, they ordered their drinks neat. Then, when they arrived, they asked for a bowl full of ice. Mrs. Kennedy wanted her salad without onions, while he asked for his without tomatoes or cucumber. She ordered her entree without broccoli and potatoes and asked if instead her filet could be served with just spinach. William asked for his pasta without the mushrooms. When her order came, she frowned down at the plate, saying, "Oh, no, I don't think I want this. Just bring me a sirloin steak, rare." The two of them ordered from busboys and called the hostess over at one point to ask for a club soda. They weren't malicious, but I can't imagine that either of them ever worked in a restaurant. April 14th, New York. I saw Helen yesterday for the first time since late January. She called me over to fix her mop, and I arrived to find her without her teeth in. "You're fat," she told me. "You need to take some of that blubber and give it to Hugh. He's got a skinny ass." May 13th. A man called last night saying he had read my book and asking if I could come clean his house. I offered to give him Bart's number, but he reiterated that he wanted me. In exchange, he said he would give me 4 stories I could put in my next book. I told him my book wasn't about other people's stories, and he got snippy and yelled, "Then why the hell don't you screen your calls?" before hanging up. June 21st. A stranger called from New Jersey to ask if I'd written a movie he'd just seen. I told him no, and he talked for a while about this and that. He offered a cure for writer's block, which was odd, as I hadn't mentioned anything about it. It turned out he's a painter who was having a hard time finishing a portrait. That was the day my typewriter broke. I couldn't work, so just sat in the rocking chair and listened to him. August 6th, La Bagotière. Things are moving along at the house. Not only do we have water, but now there's even a washing machine. This saves us from doing laundry in the tub, which always took forever, especially the wringing out part. I'm continuing to put new vocabulary words on index cards. "What does that mean?" I keep asking Hugh as he's talking to people. "How do you spell it?" He lost his patience a few hours after we arrived. In the morning, we went to the small city of Flair and ran into R and her husband P. They're a fit and attractive couple, 15 years older than us, who feel that their friends should be equally youthful and good-looking. After she'd kissed me, R put her hand on my stomach and pinched my cheek, saying that I'm fat and pale. "Look at me," she sang. "I am very bronzed. P and I have been watching the Olympics. The black people run as if they're being chased by tigers. So now we are doing the same thing. Every morning we jog in the forest. Then I go home to bronze myself." She invited us to lunch, but I begged off. 3 green beans and she's full. September 9th, New York. I walked so long and hard in Paris the other day that my overgrown toenails rubbed against one another and started to bleed. Before leaving for the airport, I went to cut them, and finding no clippers, I used a pair of Colette's poultry shears. That is exactly why you don't want people staying in your apartment when you're not there, or even when you are, really. October 10th. Amy's been called for jury duty, and she phoned from the courthouse saying, "It's a rape case, and I hope I get it. The guy is really cute." November 18th. I was on the number 6 train early yesterday evening, coming from 59th Street. The car was crowded, and I stood before a group of 3 men. All were black and in their late 20s, and all were dressed in similar-looking bomber jackets. The fellow in the middle was the heaviest of the 3, and as we got underway, he nudged me and pointed, saying, "Hey, you, there's a seat over there. Ask that lady to move her bag so you can have it." "That's okay," I said. "I'm fine standing." He pursed his lips and mocked me for his friends. "I'm fine standing." They laughed, and he continued. "I can't stand this shit with everybody putting their germs in my face. Fuckers. They're all faggots and lesbians. Faggots and lesbian. The whole city is turning faggot. Yo, man, I'm going to ask you one more time to sit the fuck down." He took his foot then, placed it against my thigh, and pushed me. "Why are you doing this?" I asked. "I mean, what difference does it make whether I stand or sit? What's it to you?" He said that I was blocking his view, and that he wanted to look at the girl seated opposite him. So I moved down the car a few feet, wondering why he couldn't have just said that in the first place, and hating him with all my might. It sickened me to hear him sweet-talk the young woman who was now back in his sight line. "You are one beautiful lady. Has anyone ever told you that?" He went on and on. And against all the advice I was telepathically sending her, she responded. "No, she wasn't married," she said, "but she did have a man in her life. Yes, she would take his phone number, but she wasn't promising anything. He called it out, and I was a fool not to write it down. If I'd had a pen on me, I'd be calling him night and day until he was forced to change his number. Yes, I'd say, 'We met on the train, and you said you wanted to get together. Don't you remember?'" November 26th. Hugh left this morning to spend Thanksgiving with his mother, Joan, whom I've taken to calling Ma Hamrick. I'm on this kick lately where I pretend she's one of my closest personal friends. Whenever I hear Hugh's key in the door, I pick up the phone and act like I'm in the middle of a conversation with her. Well, sure, I'll say. I know it's hard, but we'll get together some other time, when it can just be me and you, without Hugh to bother us. Oops, hold on, I think I hear him coming. I claim to receive gifts and checks from her, and have been writing fake letters, in which she says she wishes I were her son instead of him. It doesn't get to him because it's so ridiculous. In truth, she'd much rather hang out with Hugh than with me. Joan was here last month for a few days and spent her mornings drinking tea and reading the international section of the Times. It's the last part I'm likely to turn to, but having lived in Africa and the Middle East, the Hamricks love nothing more than to discuss foreign policy. They're forever mentioning some crisis in Karachi or Ghana and know the first and last names of countless ambassadors and attachés. They're so far removed from my own family. November 29th. I went to Amy's apartment for Thanksgiving and left for home, drunk and stoned, at 3 a.m. She had a good-sized crowd and charged her guests $5 for the chance to wear a pilgrim hat and have their picture taken with her rabbit, Tattletale. 8 people took her up on it, but in the end, not one of them paid. Lately, I'm trying to be a better listener. This involves asking questions such as, "Tell me, Lewis, do you have a lot of candles in your house?" Lewis works with Amy at Marion's, and his thing is to tell huge lies and then allow himself to be interrogated. Last night he said he was the world's first rapper.
"Really? The first?"
"Yes," he said, "and it was hard because no one believed that it would catch on and grow into this big sensation." "Did people make fun of you?" I asked. "Oh, yes, everyone."
"And did that hurt?"
It hurt a lot, an awful lot. An old neighbor of Lisa's was recently caught having sex with his Labrador retriever, and when I told Lewis about it, he asked if the dog could get pregnant.
"Are you serious?" I asked. "How old are you?"
That's one of those things you think about when you're a child, the possibility of a half-boy, half-pony. If it were possible to crossbreed like that, the world would be full of talking goats and sheep who could shear their own wool. November 30th. Helen called, offering me some gravy. I told her our refrigerator was full, and she launched into her suspicion that our 75-year-old neighbor is creeping into her apartment while she's asleep. It makes no sense, but she is convinced that something is going on. She then recounted her recent fights with the people at the grocery store and the construction crew renovating the apartment upstairs from her. After that, she talked about her nephew and the reasons she didn't go to her daughter's house for Thanksgiving. Her monologue went on for 20 minutes and ended with, "So if you don't want my gravy, go fuck yourself." December 18th. We met last night for the first read-through of the play, The Little Frida Mysteries, and I felt bad for everyone in the room. What I'd written was so clunky and full of exposition, I wouldn't blame any of them for trying to back out. One scene between Amy and Chuck Coggins has potential, but the rest will have to be scrapped. At the copy shop on Prince Street, an hour or so before our meeting, I stood in line behind a woman with dyed black hair. She was taking forever, color Xeroxing photos of herself, and said to the guy behind the counter that though she pays next to nothing in rent, she's looking for a new apartment. "I got 2 lizards on Thompson Street, but they're not getting any light."
January 29th, New York. On Monday, The New Yorker arranged for Amy and me to have our pictures taken by Dwayne Michaels. This so they can run it in the goings-on about town section. I was a big fan of his when I was in my early 20s, all those photos with the cursive writing along the bottoms of them. Amy and I promised ourselves we wouldn't do anything stupid, and an hour later we were sitting on top of a battered piano with our arms in slings. Mr. Michaels was what you might call a wild card, and at the end of the session our mouths ached from fake laughing. "Did you know that Flaubert had a second career as a gynecologist? He wrote a book about it called Madame Ovary."
Years back, he had been shooting an upside-down model who accidentally kicked him in the head with his heavy boots and crushed his skull. Now there are metal plates in it. February 3rd. The New Yorker is taking the Shouts and Murmurs piece I wrote for Valentine's Day. Chris sent the galleys by messenger, and reading them over, I noticed four repetitions of the phrase, "We're hoping." I pointed this out on the phone yesterday, and he said, "Man, you're like a self-cleaning oven." February 4th. I had a horrible experience today with a photographer named Chris who'd come to take my picture for some magazine. We were trying to prepare a tech rehearsal for the play, and because we were so busy, I asked if we could meet at the theater. Chris thought it might be nice to use the basement hallway, so we went downstairs, where he and his assistant set up their lights and umbrellas. I'm finding it progressively more difficult to have my picture taken, especially now, when there always has to be a gimmick. The idea is that you have to be humiliated in order for your personality to shine through. You need to hang from the ceiling by a hook or crawl on your hands and knees through a puddle of something. Chris started the session by handing me a package of stage cigarettes he wanted me to cram into my mouth the entire thing. "I'm catching some reflection off the packaging," he said, "so can you lower your head a little?" Normally, I just do what they tell me, figuring the quicker I surrender, the sooner I'll get out of there. Today, though, I snapped. "I can't do this," I said, after taking the package out of my mouth. "It makes me feel silly." "If it makes you feel silly," he said, "you need to find another way to do it. If I give you a wacky idea, you should give me one that's even wackier." I told him it wasn't my job to out-wacky him, that I'm not a comedian, or even an actor for that matter, and that I saw nothing wrong with just a normal photo of me, standing or sitting in a chair. And that was pretty much the end of that. He told me about some other difficult people he'd worked with, and I defended them all. I mean, really, how is it that someone wants to tie you to the railroad tracks and refusing makes you the bad guy? I told him about the photographer I had last week who wanted me to spit onto a pane of glass and then press my face against it. "That sounds interesting," Chris said. "What was his name?" I told him I didn't remember, and he nodded, saying, "That tells me everything I need to know." February 15th. Tiffany arrived yesterday for a short visit. She's on mood stabilizers, and they seem to have made a significant difference. She listens to people now. Doesn't get angry quite so easily. I took her with me to Little Brown and introduced her to everyone. Hugh made a rack of lamb for dinner, and then we all went to the play and out for drinks afterward. She's especially entertaining when talking about Ludovic, the French guy who stayed with her for a while. He said to me, "I like you, Tiffany, but I don't love you." She'd responded that here in America, if you don't love someone, you don't tell them, rather you just say nothing. I wish I'd written it down verbatim. It was so funny, the way she said it. March 5th. Dad came to town for the book release party, and I woke him this morning at 4. A short while later, I accompanied him to 6th Avenue, where he caught a taxi to Penn Station. It was still dark, and a lot of remarkable people were out. A man screaming about shitty black criminals, a sobbing woman, the drunk super from across the street. Funny how normal it all seems to me now. Before getting into his cab, Dad shook my hand and told me to be a good boy. He said it as though I were 7 years old and as if he didn't know that I had grown up. It made me so sad. March 28th, Iowa City, Iowa. Someone told me that Minneapolis, where I was yesterday, is the slimmest city in the United States. I don't know if that's true, but it did have a laundromat called the Spin Cycle. I passed a gift shop called the Cardvark. I did a reading in a gay bookstore called A Brother's Touch. It was what I'd feared it might be, lots of rainbow-striped flags and windsocks. My mic was set up in the magazine section, so behind me were pictures of all sorts of men, some in jock straps, some with gags that looked like ping-pong balls in their mouths. What killed me, though, was the incense, which was coconut, I think. March 29th, Atlanta, Georgia. The Cedar Rapids Airport was decorated for Easter. They'd put plastic grass, marshmallow chicks, and plastic eggs atop the X-ray scanner, and I was looking at them when one of the guards, a young woman, asked to check my bag. She found the bottle of scotch that Little Brown had sent me and said, "I'm sorry, sir, but I'm going to have to pour this out." I thought that maybe this was a rule in Iowa, but then her boss stepped over and said, "No, Tanya, you don't pour it out. You just need to smell it and make certain it's not gasoline." "Really? I've been pouring it out for the last 2 months." "Well, you shouldn't have been," her supervisor told her. The woman named Tanya opened my bottle of scotch, held it to her nose, and winced. "Now I got liquor on my hands," she said. "Great." Her supervisor rolled her eyes. "Oh, just go over to the fountain, add a little water, and have a drink," she said, sighing. "It'll do you some good." April 13th, Portland. This morning at the Seattle airport, I saw a kid, maybe 10 years old, jerking his head every 15 seconds or so. It was like seeing myself as a boy. His father said, "Aaron, I'm warning you." I wanted to rush over and scoop the kid up. May 10th, New York. I finished Nickel Dreams, the new Tanya Tucker autobiography. Every time she used the phrase, "my new friend," I pulled out my pen, knowing there would be a great name coming. The book is full of them, my favorites being Peanut Montgomery, Sonny Throckmorton, Michael Smotherman, Dave Dudley, and Sheila Slaughter. May 17th, La Bagotière. Mr. G's new colt is sick, so we went to the barn and watched as he milked the mother. He then fed the baby from a bottle, eventually taking the nipple off and pouring the milk down its throat, saying, "Come on now, drink." His wife then shoved a thermometer up the colt's ass, and together they force-fed it some paraffin oil, all this because the vet charges extra on weekends. Coming from New York, I find it really shocking to spend time around animals. The baby geese are in the garage, their backs bare and bloody from where they've plucked one another's feathers out. Lambs are in their pen. They're friendly, the babies, but already their coats are caked with dirt and shit. In the pen next to theirs, a 9-year-old ewe sits on all fours, facing a bowl full of mush. All her teeth have fallen out, so she can no longer graze or eat hay or pellets. June 19th, New York. I was watching The Simpsons last night when Tiffany called. She had just spent a month in Raleigh, and it was strange listening to her talk about it. Then Gretchen wanted me to change the hat on her taxidermied beaver, and I said, "Are you telling me or asking me?" She was particularly bothered about a lamp and how she needed Dad to put it in his car and bring it to her at Paul's place. "This is about respect," she kept saying, as I looked at the TV screen with the sound turned off, wondering what I was missing. June 27th. Last night I talked to Paul, who lamented, "I ain't seen pussy in so long I'd throw stones at it." I wished it weren't too late to add that line to our play. Then I noticed that we're listed in the special children's section of Time Out. "Our show," Amy said when I told her about it, "the one that includes the pot smoking and cursing and has the line, 'Psst, Glenn, hey Glenn, you want a blowjob?' in it?" I'll worry about it tomorrow. June 28th. As if Amy didn't have enough to do with learning her lines, one of her friends has invited herself over to cook eels. I don't know how she gets herself into these things. She was in the drugstore today and saw a female police officer open a bottle of base makeup, cover a blemish on her nose, and then place the bottle back on the shelf. A cop. July 1st. We did a read-through of the play for 15 people from Lincoln Center, and when we were finished, John, the man in charge of the festival, stood up saying, "Well, I don't care what anyone says. I liked it." Afterward, I walked through the park for a while, thinking. On my way back home, a woman, very thin with a missing front tooth, entered my subway car and said, "Can I please get a little fucking attention?" When no one looked up, she called us a bunch of stuck-up snobs. "You'll give money to those other bitches. You'll help them, but not me, so fuck you."
She got up in someone's face, and the young woman gave her money, as did the next person she confronted.
"Well, that's just fucking great," the woman said. "Fucking great, shitheads."
July 6th. Last week, Amy gave Hugh and me a large plastic tankard of industrial cooking oil for deep fat frying, and this afternoon I carried it to the laundromat, having mistaken it for the nearly identical tankard of detergent, same size, same color. The only difference was a spout. That's what stopped me from pouring a cupful of it into the top of the machine. If I had, the best thing to do would have been to walk away, buy new clothes and sheets and towels, and never return to that laundromat again. I'm guessing stuff would be pretty much ruined after going through an oil cycle.
July 11th. Last night was one of the happiest of my life. The play was sold out, every seat taken, with folding chairs set up at the back of the theater. I had no idea our Times review was out until Amy called to tell me about it. Then I heard from Drew, the choreographer, who read it out loud to me before I could stop him. It's as if I wrote it myself as a joke. They mentioned Hugh's set and his inventive direction. Vulgarity just shouldn't be this funny, but it's being ridiculed, reveled in. Really? We ridiculed it? I hoped they'd praise all the actors equally, and it hurts that they left out Toby and Sarah. I can't understand their choices, but it's a glowing review. After last night's performance, the Lincoln Center Festival people took us to dinner at a swank restaurant. I was so certain this play would fail.
July 28th. Last night I watched Alien Autopsy, Fact or Fiction, a 10-minute program stretched out to an hour. Is this genuine film footage of a visitor from another planet, or just a cruel hoax designed to prey upon our worst fears? We'll be back in a moment. I kept waiting for the actual autopsy, but for the most part we saw the same shot over and over. A doctor in a protective outfit gesturing with a fountain pen toward the alien's flesh wound. The alien itself looked like a child in a Halloween mask, its genitals blurred out with one of those scramblers. Interviewed were several people who had witnessed the Roswell crash 50 years ago. An unstable-looking woman said she was threatened by government officials to keep silent. We saw the saucer on the ground, and two little people who were crying and trying to resuscitate a third alien who looked like he was more than likely dead. Then the two live ones ran over and clutched this metal box. I don't know what was in it, but remember thinking, that box means something to those two aliens.
July 29th. Ben Brantley wrote an overall review of the Lincoln Center Festival in yesterday's Times. "Astonish me," Diaghilev's much-quoted artistic dictum, is the imperative brought by the sort of people who attend self-defined cultural events like Les Danaïdes. But only the Sedaris' incident provided astonishment. This brother and sister playwriting team has an unparalleled ear for American cultural clichés and an equally fine hand for twisting those clichés into devastating absurdity. The news of the review was ruined by a call from a People magazine photographer. They're running a story about the book, and she phoned saying she'd like a picture of me either wearing a towel or peeking out from behind my shower curtain. This is what happens when you choose the title Naked over, say, Quiet Dignity. August 31st, La Bagotière. Hugh and I awoke to the news that Princess Diana has been killed, literally hounded to death by photographers. I've been listening all morning to the BBC. Correspondents interview one person after another, one of them an agony expert, who said it's often very painful when people die. October 3rd, New York. Tiffany called collect this morning, sobbing and saying she can't leave the house. It happens every so often. Other days she can leave, but still wakes up crying. I feel bad for her, but can't understand the problem. Isn't there some kind of medication for this? She talks about Mom, about the school she was sent to 20 years ago, all this stuff from the past, over and over. October 5th. Hugh and I went with Amy and Mitch to see Kiss the Girls, the worst thing I've seen in a long time. It was another of those I think we've got a serial killer on our hands, thrillers. I sat beside a stranger, and 20 minutes into it we were nudging one another and rolling our eyes. Making it worse, I had to sit through another endless preview for Titanic. Who do they think is going to see that movie? October 18th, Columbus, Ohio. I was met at the Columbus airport by a fellow named Rick who was kind and positive and announced with genuine excitement that he was taking me to a restaurant called Johnny Rockets for lunch. "You'll totally love it," he said. "It's a 50s-style place where the waitresses chew gum and offer to draw things on your hamburger buns with plastic ketchup squeezers. They sing sometimes, too, and give you a nickel so you can play the little jukeboxes they have on the tables." It sounded awful to me, but I didn't want to disappoint him, so we went, my teeth gritted. When the waitress did indeed offer to sketch something on my hamburger bun, I requested a swastika, and then wished I hadn't. "Or a face," I said. "A happy face would be great, too." Rick, bless him, reminded us that before it was taken over by the Nazis and turned into something ugly, the swastika was a Celtic symbol of good luck. After lunch, he took me to Target, and I learned he'd recently won a year of free groceries by entering a sweepstakes at Big Bear, a local supermarket chain. October 20th, New York. Women are angry in New York tonight. On the corner of Houston and Thompson, I heard a black woman yell at her boyfriend, "Because let me tell you something, motherfucker, I don't need you." Continuing south down West Broadway, I fell in behind a white couple, the woman walking several steps in front of her boyfriend. "Don't you ever fucking shush me, you asshole, especially in front of an employee." Apparently, he'd been trying to make a dinner reservation and asked her to pipe down so he could hear the hostess on the payphone he was using. This was clearly the wrong thing to do. She went from being shushed to complaining about the stupid way he goes about giving and receiving information. Like whenever we get into a cab and you ask the driver how he's doing tonight, and nobody fucking cares how he's doing. Least of all him. All he wants is a goddamn address, and there you are trying to be his best friend, so don't shush me. He didn't do much in terms of defending himself, and I got the idea that dinner would be one long tirade. It's pretty rare to go from a fight to a pleasant meal. Maybe he could have said, "You know something? You're right. I apologize. That was thoughtless, and I'll never do it again." I followed them for blocks, hoping he might take this approach, but he never did. It irritated me, the way she kept snapping her fingers to make a point. I wondered what he was doing with her, but by the time we hit Broome Street, I wondered what she was doing with him. October 23rd. I think it's strange that neither of Hugh's parents bought the People magazine he's in. His father says, "I'm not wasting $3, just tell me what the article says." His mother leafed through an issue at Target, then phoned to say, "I've got better pictures of you at home." Any other parent would have bought a dozen copies. It's not like getting a set of encyclopedias. I mean, really. November 20th. Paul called from Raleigh and told me he had two black eyes. Apparently, he started a fight with a guy in a bar, a guy who was much taller than him, and stocky. "And when did he stop beating you?" "When he was done." November 26th. Walking back from the movie theater, I cut through that little pedestrian area between 3rd and 4th Streets. There, a white man, a guy around my age, was sitting on a bench and screaming, "Are you fucking deaf? I asked you what time it is." He was yelling at a group of 3 young women, one of them Japanese. When none of them answered, he got up off his bench and followed them. "Hey, you! That's right, Jap! I asked you a fucking question!" One of the women turned around then. "I'm sorry," she said. "I didn't realize you were talking to us." "Don't fucking apologize," the man screamed. "Just give me the fucking time!"
This happened a few hours ago, yet I can't stop thinking about it and hating myself for being such a coward. The correct answer to the man's question was, it's time for you to learn some fucking manners. He wasn't a lunatic, but you could tell he'd spent some time in prison. I wonder what he'll be doing for Thanksgiving. Then I wonder where he learned how to ask people questions.
November 29th. I went to have my hair cut and sat in the chair beside a man who'd just gotten out of jail. The barber asked what he'd been in for, and he answered, aggravated assault. I had to beat up some Italian woman because she didn't know how to keep her mouth shut. I thought the barber, who was Italian, might slit the guy's throat, but instead, he just turned the TV up.
December 20th.
I bought a half dozen books this week on horrible diseases, some for me and some to give to Gretchen for Christmas. My favorite picture is of a woman with horrible arthritis. Her fingers are twisted and tapered, almost like carrots, yet her nails are beautifully manicured and painted. She's working with what she has. The same is true of the gum diseases, viewed through lipstick mouths.
December 26th.
Continuing our tradition of seeing movies about black people on Christmas Day, after opening presents, Dad, Lisa, Paul, Amy, and I went to see Jackie Brown. Last year, I think it was The Preacher's Wife, and the year before that, Waiting to Exhale. We really wanted to see Soul Food this year, but the only screening was at 9 a.m. Afterward, over dinner, Dad mentioned a woman we used to know from church. I saw her not long ago, and golly, she looked just like a man, he said. She got a beard and everything, like a bristled hog. When Gretchen scolded him, he said that he hadn't meant that as an insult. The hairs of a bristled hog are used to craft some of the finest brushes there are, both for painting and shaving. I used to have one, as a matter of fact.
January 1st, New York.
I went to Helen's to deliver the tangerines she'd asked for, and she answered her door looking like an old mafia capo in big dark sunglasses. I fell and broke the regular ones, she told me. We hung out for a while in her kitchen, and before I left she gave me a nutmeg-colored pantsuit she thought Amy might wear. All my friends have fat asses, so I don't have nobody else that would fit. Tell her to wash it in wool light, or what the fuck, tell her she can wash it in any old shit.
January 2nd.
A young woman called saying, who is this? I asked who she was calling for, and she said, what number is this? After I told her, she said, you don't have to yell at me. Then she said she'd call back in a few minutes and hung up. Several hours later, a man called and asked if I was David Sedaris. Me and a bunch of friends bought you a present and want to come over and give it to you. I said it wasn't a good time and suggested he call me back tomorrow. How dumb is that?
January 7th.
I went to deliver Helen her chicken cutlets, and she sang I Got You, Babe, in honor of Sonny Bono, who died 2 days ago in a skiing accident. I like that chastity, she said, and her father was very understanding when she told him she was lesbian. I stayed for an hour, and she recounted the various fights she's had this week. I'm not a troublemaker. I just stay out of it now. Before I left, she gave me another pantsuit to give to Amy, one with a studded top. It's hard to imagine Helen in it, but she swears she used to wear it to church. The Monsignor said, hey, hotshot, where's your horse? I told him it was in the garage. Ha! You laugh, but that's what I told him.
January 20th.
The woman below us, Franny, died last night, a few months shy of her 106th birthday. Helen told me about it and said, my mother died when she was 46. I remember asking her, hey, Ma, what are you going to give me for my birthday? She said, I'll give you something you'll never forget. And she did. She died. That Helen. Everything has to be about her.
January 21st.
I called my agent, Don, to discuss the Little Brown situation, and he began by talking about Mary Todd Lincoln. Then he moved on to Abe Lincoln, and then to FDR. The mention of Bill Clinton heartened me as we were finally moving into the present decade, but then he went back to Collier's Magazine before finally saying it's best just to sit tight and let Little Brown make the next move. January 24th. I listened to a lot of talk radio today. The president is caught up in a sex scandal that could ruin him if it's proven he encouraged the young woman to lie to the grand jury or whoever it was who needed to be lied to. One station offered a prize to whoever could give the scandal the best name. I'm sick of attaching the suffix gate to everything, though it's hard to sneeze at either fornigate or tailgate, the top two contenders. Who knows what will come of it? January 26th. While straight men watched the Super Bowl on NBC, the other networks fought it out for the women and homosexuals. Funny Girl was on Channel 9, and the Bette Midler remake of Gypsy played on Channel 2. Meanwhile, Channel 13's Nature Special was devoted to cats. Hugh and I switched back and forth from musical to musical to the mother calico teaching her young to hunt. It's a lesson that Dennis, our cat, apparently slept through. February 10th. Helen called me over to rub some tiger balm into her back. Our mutual neighbor, Joe, had offered to do it, but she turned him away, saying she didn't want to get raped. "I'm not into that," she told me, "especially in my own bed." The other night she confided that her real name is Elena, and that her childhood nickname was Rocky because she got into so many fights. She sent me home with some spaghetti sauce that had chunks of chicken breast in it. Hugh threw it into the garbage, just as he threw away the veal she gave me the day before yesterday. February 13th. A German publisher has offered a nice advance for Naked, and Don thinks we should take it. "Eh, that's what the Japs coughed up," he said. February 15th. Helen called at 8 a.m. and then again 3 hours later. "Get over here. I made you the chicken with the potatoes and peas." I went and she told me about her latest fight with the deli on Spring and Sullivan. The delivery boy is deaf, and Helen's accusing him of stealing her pen. Seems a simple enough mistake. The kid probably used it and then accidentally stuck it in his pocket. I think of how confused he must have been when Helen lunged at him, demanding it back. She later called the deli, saying, "That freak ain't allowed in my house no more. He wants a tip? Let him keep the fucking pen." She accuses the Grand Union delivery men of stealing canned goods from her order and selling them on the street. That's how paranoid she's gotten. February 16th. Lots of domestic violence on cops tonight. A young woman is punched in the face, and her boyfriend goes bananas when officers enter his trailer to arrest him. He's strong, and it takes 3 men to bring him down. Meanwhile, his girlfriend is screaming, "I only want to talk to you, baby." To the cops, she pleads, "He didn't mean to hurt y'all. He was just scared." As the boyfriend is taken away, he yells, "I ain't never going to forgive you for this, Randy. When I get out, I am going to fuck you up." She answers, "Do you want me to pay your bail?" "See," the guy says to her as he's pushed into the car, "they don't know what you're like. They don't know how you talk to me, how you make me have to beat you up." "I'm sorry," she cries. "I'll get you out tonight." February 22nd. They're broadcasting the closing ceremonies of the Winter Olympic Games in Nagano. That means I can return to writing without having Hugh yell every 5 minutes, "David, get in here, hurry!" I sat him down the other night and explained as gently as possible that I do not care about ice skating. I do not care about Michelle Kwan or Tara Lipinski, and would be happy if I never hear the words triple Lutz or double axel again. I told him that on Friday, and walked into the kitchen an hour later to find him in tears. "It's heartbreaking," he said, watching his beloved skaters. Last night he called me in to watch Michelle Kwan do her final routine. The competition is over, but they're allowing the skaters to come back and do whatever they want without fear of judgment. They don't let the bobsledders do it, but apparently the ice skaters have a lot of fans like Hugh who can't get enough. Right now they're killing time with a soft news segment explaining that rice is very important to the people of Nagano. The narrator is taking his 3-minute story and stretching it out to 10. The secret is to talk very slowly. March 4th. I called my drug delivery service, and they sent a young white man named Luke. Like all of them, he arrived on a bicycle and knocked on the door with 4 different grades of pot. I complained about the construction noise coming from the hotel they're building next door, and he said with sympathy, "Oh, dude." I asked where he lived, and he said, "Williamsburg. It's like a party place, but really laid back." Luke was like a parody of a stoner. I think that's what I liked about him. I hated if the person selling me pot in the middle of the day was super articulate. That would make me feel like even more of a loser. March 13th. Helen fell this afternoon, and I watched the paramedics carry her down the stairs. According to Joe, she'd been up on a chair, changing a light bulb, and may have broken her hip. Her daughter arrived, dressed in a fur coat, and said, "You must be Dave, the one she drives crazy. Welcome to the club." March 19th. Hugh goes through phases with the New York Times crossword puzzle. He'll do them religiously for a few months and then drop off entirely. Sometimes I'll look over his shoulder, and whenever I get a correct answer, I'll feel so smart and capable. Before she died, Mom started doing the crosswords from the Raleigh News and Observer. She bought a book of easy puzzles, and it broke my heart to find them in the bathroom wastebasket. 3-letter word for placed out of sight, and she'd have written put instead of hid. I never cared about puzzles one way or another until this weekend when I completed the crossword in this week's People. The clues were, I'll admit, pretty simple. All blank blank family. Singer once married to Sonny. It was on a 5th grade level, but after I finished, I couldn't stop staring at it. I showed it to Hugh and then went through the recycling pile on the curb and found 2 more people's. I love getting stoned and doing the crossword, but they're even better first thing in the morning. March 27th. Ken Shore is in town and dropped by this morning. We went for a coffee on Sullivan Street and were sitting at an outdoor table when an elderly man approached and asked if we could help him lower a plant into a hole he just dug. It was a strange and unexpected request, so we said yes and allowed him to lead us up the street and into a building I must have passed 500 times. It had an elevator, and he pushed the button for the basement, explaining that this was his son-in-law's apartment. "He's Chinese," he added, "and is composing an opera. I hoped the maid could help me with the plant, but unfortunately she's not strong enough." In the basement, we walked down a dark, narrow hallway and into a clean-smelling apartment. It opened onto a small backyard where the man gestured to a good-sized tree, its roots contained in a sizable burlap ball. Must have weighed 300 pounds, and he needed it carried up 4 steps and then dragged to a hole 6 feet away. Ken and I tried to lift it, but it took all we had, and within seconds it was back on the ground with us over it, panting. "I can't believe your maid couldn't handle this on her own," Ken said, gasping for air. "Mine could carry 2 trees, and still managed to breastfeed the children." The man blinked. On the second try, we got it up a single stair, then another and another. On nearing the hole, we realized that it was way too shallow. Someone needed to make it deeper, but it wasn't going to be either of us. The man was so frail that it might have taken him hours, so we said nothing and lowered the tree into the 2 shallow hole where it looked pathetic. March 28th. Hugh and I went to visit Helen in the hospital, and throughout our half-hour stay, I wondered if we didn't have the wrong room. She's been literally defanged and without her teeth, it was difficult to understand what she was saying. "How are you?" Hugh asked. She pointed at the wall and told him to open the refrigerator. Her hair has grown out since I last saw her. The copper-colored henna is gone, and she looks a good 20 years older. She later told her daughter Anne that two men